so serious.
All the toys, all the time.
I am the game and still getting trying to play dude.
You know the rules. This isn't a toy.
But we bought it at the toy store.
We did, but the way I'm using it makes it an adult thing.
Are you ready to play the game?
Yeah! Welcome to the toy department with Matt Kolsky and Derek Madden.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, we're back for another episode of the toy department. I'm Derek Madden. He's Matt Kolsky.
Hey,
how you doing, man? How was your week?
Not bad. Not bad. Feeling pretty good. I this was the week slash weekend where I finally like got back to my normal life and stopped hopping around our fair nation and actually got some sleep. So I feel fresh.
Yeah, this is like I feel like settle week for most people. Like you're fully back in work routine, which is nice when they throw that MLK holiday at you.
Oh, they throw that at you?
Just as you're ready. Yeah.
Yeah, they don't throw that at me.
How does that work? We work in the same company. It's a company holiday. You didn't get it thrown?
Tis indeed a company holiday. However, the folks who are slightly lower on the totem pole in the on-air departments often have to pick up those on-air shifts. So yeah. I was, in fact, on the air on
MLK Day.
People
don't really understand. I try to explain it to them that radio is like – it's like – working for the postal service, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you might get a day off, and there might be a day where the mail isn't being delivered.
Yeah.
But the mail's still coming.
Yep.
Mail's still coming, and it's still waiting for you when you get back.
Oh, so, yeah.
You know, if you're on the production side, you're still going to be cranking out content all the time. And if you take a week off, you're really working a week ahead to get ready for the week off half the time. So.
Yeah, the old radio. That's like that's the one where I have friends who are like, "Oh, I'm in an office three blocks from you. Let's do lunch." And I'm like, "No, I don't really get lunch because I gotta run and eat my lunch in the kitchen real fast, and then be back on the air 15 minutes later. So
right.
It's not gonna work, folks. Yeah, it's one of the downsides of the radio business. That being said,
lot of upside. Yeah, I don't want to complain too much because I can just hear the podcast. The iPhones just.
Radio guys complaining about radio. Click.
Yeah, exactly. All right, so on the show today, we're gonna get into some movies with Room and The Hateful Eight. I'm gonna talk a little bit about TBS and TNT, and
they know funny. No way.
Yeah, what you can do in the
very drama
new era of TV. And we've been promising forever our all-time favorite trash talkers.
Yeah.
And we'll get into that a little bit later in the show. But I wanted to start with Glenn Frey. And the reason that I wanted to start with Glenn Frey, who passed away Monday, right, was because I mentioned it to you as we were prepping. And I got a reaction that I feel like has been fairly common.
Yeah.
This week, which is basically like, do we? Glenn Frey?
Yeah. I don't want to speak ill of the dead. I got no problems with Glenn Frey. I don't especially care about the Eagles or love the Eagles. I think what I actually said to you was, I'm with Lebowski. I just don't. They're soft rock, and that's fine. But I don't have much to say about someone in a soft rock band.
It's all right. So this is really, and this is kind of, I guess maybe this is what I find interesting about the whole thing, because Glenn Frey dies so close to David Bowie.
Yeah.
And you compare the reactions. Bowie versus Frey, and the tributes, and not undeserved for Bowie, were universally glowing and this impact on the culture. And I feel like the reaction to Glenn Frey has almost consistently been, yeah, but. And The New York Daily News, I think it was. Not even the New York Post, which is who you expect this from. Like, basically, ran a feature from, like, a music critic that was basically like, Glenn Frey's why the Eagles suck. Like, it's amazing to me that the Eagles have now become this thing that it's almost, like, universally okay to crap on.
Yeah. Do you disagree?
No defense. I guess
my question is to you, are the Eagles a really good band in your eyes?
Are the Eagles a really good band in my eyes? I would say the Eagles are definitely a good band, and I would say the Eagles are a massively impactful and influential band.
Why impactful?
And not getting their due respect here in this case. Okay, so let's just start with the sheer number of records they've moved. I would venture to say that the Eagles' greatest hits, simply just the Eagles' greatest hits, has sold more records than David Bowie's entire catalog. In fact, I'm almost certain that that's the case.
Okay, but I mean,
that's not my case for impact and influence. Okay. That's just where I'm gonna start with the Eagles. Their impact.
To sort of address that first point, I would imagine that Britney Spears has an album that sold more than any of those things, right?
No. Britney Spears does not have an album that sold more than the Eagles' greatest hits.
Okay, then
I think there are like, and I'll do my homework on this probably while you're making a point here in a second. I think you could probably count the number of records that have sold more than the Eagles' greatest hits on one hand, would be my guess. Certainly,
you're right.
Two.
Actually, the list of single albums that have sold 40 million copies or more is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 albums long, and the Eagles are number 6.
Yes.
Here are the 5. You want to know the 5?
Yeah, hit me.
I would say all 5 are significantly better than the Eagles' greatest hits, and that includes Meatloaf's Bat Out of Hell, Whitney Houston's The Bodyguard soundtrack, which obviously has other people on it as well, Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon, AC/DC's Back in Black, and of course, Thriller.
Yeah, right. All right, but you're talking
surprised
about,
Legend isn't on here.
You're talking about pretty select company here.
Yeah.
Now,
select company, yes, but you know what comes right after the Eagles?
What's right after the Eagles? ABBA?
Close. Saturday Night Fever soundtrack.
Saturday Night Fever. All right. Hey, look, I would defend the Saturday Night Fever soundtrack.
How?
Wait, so you're anti-Bee Gees? Is that what you're saying?
Like, no, I'm not. No. Hold on. I have listened to the Eagles plenty in my life, and I have listened to a fair bit of the Saturday Night Fever soundtrack. But I wouldn't call that good or important or impactful.
Well, okay. Certainly, I mean, the Saturday Night Fever soundtrack.
I have listened to Call Me Maybe.
That's an entire genre of music. Don't hate on Call Me Maybe. That sounds genius.
It's great. I've listened to it easily 100 times. But yeah. is it impactful or really good music? I don't think I would say that it is.
Here's what I mean by impactful.
Okay.
I think that you can trace 3 entire radio formats to the Eagles. And I would say, now, are they great formats? You could certainly argue that what we know of as classic rock radio today started with the Eagles. And there's if you've seen the Eagles documentary, which I highly, highly recommend, the history of the Eagles, whether you like the Eagles or not, you'll enjoy the documentary. They kind of get into literally how that's how that started, was the programmers realized there was a hole for people playing Eagles music on the radio at some point in like the late 70s, early 80s. And that was kind of the basis around a lot of which that, you know, we think of classic rock as like Beatles and Stones and Jimi Hendrix, but it's a lot more 70s based and 80s based than that. After the Eagles broke up, that's kind of when classic rock radio started. obviously the 70s AM gold kind of radio genre that I think you tend to think of the Eagles as. And on top of that, the sound of country music today is heavily, heavily, heavily influenced by the Eagles. And I would say that...
Isn't that a horrible disaster, though?
The people who have been nicest to them, or nicest, you know what I mean, most glowing in the tributes to Glenn Frey have been all the country people.
Well, that tracks for me, because I think country music is basically crap.
Right. Look, I'm not here to defend the state of modern country music. Yeah. I'm not here to say the Eagles are a great band, even. But I think they're a very good
band. What
are
you here for?
and I do think that when you look at the to just call them a soft rock band is I feel like a gross oversimplification. Like the band, that's a band that A, was around forever, changed a lot over that time, brought in a guy, you know, started from like a 70s California folk thing.
Yes, yeah, okay. You know, we're getting right at what bothers me.
But brought in a guy like Joe Walsh because they wanted to do beefier, rockier things. Uh-huh. And if literally they had never written another song, they wrote Hotel California. And like, that is a song that no matter what you think of them as people, or how many times you've heard it, and I guarantee the number is way too many, whatever it is.
Yes.
That is an amazing song.
It's a great song. It's a great song, and much like the skewering Daily News article you spoke of, I would essentially credit anything that ever really rocked from the Eagles to Joe Walsh. I'm a Joe Walsh fan.
Well, look, Frey had a lot to do with that, with a lot of the more rocking
I'm sure
songs.
He did. Look, if we were to first of all, I think it should be said that my Eagles knowledge is probably not good enough to even have this conversation. Second of all, that might be a slight exaggeration, but frankly, I don't love them, and so I don't know a ton about them.
Right. Okay.
Second of all, I just think most of the stuff you just credited to them is bad stuff. And that's sort of like, I think I would have said most of the same things describing what's frustrating and upsetting about the Eagles that you just said in defense of the Eagles. The fact is,
but you're not going to deny that they're impactful, right? Like that is impactful.
Yes, it's impactful, but again, most of that was bad impact. It's turning country music from an original genre that I may not have liked, but I could at least have respected, into trash pop. Essentially what you're saying is they're responsible for Shania Twain. You know, the thing that upsets me the most, I believe, in rock music is people who don't rock, who want to be rock musicians. And folk is at the heart of that disaster. I just don't. If you want to be a folk musician, that's fine. But plugging in and playing that soft crap through an amplifier does not make it rock and roll.
Yeah, see, I fully disagree with that. So are you hating on Fleetwood Mac too?
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah. See, I have a real problem with.
Hating is a strong word for Fleetwood Mac, but yeah, it's folk pop. Pop is fine if people like folk pop, but folk pop does not a great rock and roll band make.
No, see, music is dynamics, and you can, you know, loud is important, and loud matters, but quiet matters just as much, and you can do both well.
You can do both well.
That's dangerous.
Pink Floyd does both well.
And unsettling. Yeah. Yes. But, you know, it's not always necessarily about dangerous and unsettling, and the Eagles were... the Eagles weren't all sunshine and lollipops.
Okay,
let
me ask you this.
Like, it's not all peaceful, easy feeling.
No, but what percentage of the Eagles' music would you say was crafted specifically to be easy to listen to? Because I would say a huge portion.
Portion. I would say less. You mean, what you're really talking about when you're talking about, like, easy listening Eagles was like their first couple of records that were definitely like more country influenced. You know what I mean? And I would say, look, you know,
Take It Easy. I mean, Jackson Browne wrote a song called Take It Easy that was a early rock song that really was pretty folky, and the Eagles softened it.
Yeah, no, Take It Easy and Peaceful Easy Feeling, and you know, yes, that, but that's just like a fairly small period of the Eagles. You know
I
what
guess,
I mean?
Like, and then Life in, you know, you get to like Life in the Fast Lane, and to me, that's a Steve Miller Band ripoff. You know, there's just not to me the Hotel California is the
yes,
one.
Yeah, I would go the other way, by the way. And say Steve, that's Steve Miller ripping off the Eagles, but
I'd have to look into timing on that, I suppose.
but you know, here's what I'll do. I just say this is the homework for all of you on this one. A lot of times we ask you to watch things. Watch the first part. It's a 2-part documentary of the history of the Eagles. You can find it around. It aired on Showtime a bunch. For you, Kolsky, I have it on DVD, and I will freaking mail it to you. I don't
wow.
have to watch it that much. It's just interesting. And I think it'll give you a little bit more perspective on the band and the people therein. You'll really enjoy it. Simmons wrote a fantastic column on it a few years back. So, you know, at the end of the day, like, I'm not going to sit here and ride for Glenn Frey, but I feel like it's weird that we're basically treating this as, like, if a guy from Air Supply died. You know what I mean? And it's not that. It's not that.
Are you sure it's not just a better known Air Supply?
Yes. I'm sure.
All right. You're the music radio guy. I guess I got to defer to you on that one.
We're going
to
move on. Watch the documentary.
All right.
You wanted to mention Room.
Yeah. Quickly, just before we move on, I feel like I should mention that when I Googled the Eagles, the number one news story that comes up is Glenn Frey, how Hotel California destroyed the Eagles. So he thinks their best song destroyed the band, just putting that
yeah.
out there.
Well, doesn't that happen to a lot of bands, the best song destroys them?
Not good bands.
A lot of bands, you know?
Not the good ones.
I mean, it's not their best song, but my favorite band spent an entire career trying to get out from under Creep. You know what I mean?
Oh. Yeah, so, I guess, except that they did it very successfully.
They did it very well, but that's sort of what makes them, like, part of what makes them great, isn't it?
Agreed. You know what I mean? So talk to me about the period where the Eagles got out from under Hotel California and made something great. I don't remember
but,
that.
But that's totally – it's a very different thing. Right? Because Hotel California came along so much later in the Eagles' career.
Yeah, because they never did much that was worth anything before. Anyway, all right, this is mean to talk about a dead
person
this way.
That is mean.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Glenn Frey.
Inaccurate.
Look, Glenn Frey was super popular and super loved by a ton of people who I don't think know a ton about music, but that does not lessen his impact or importance, and it certainly doesn't speak to his character. So rest in peace, Glenn Frey.
All right, fair enough. And also, you know, I mean, look, yeah. Hey, Springsteen's on board. He knows a few things about music.
Yeah, well, we could have that discussion another time.
Okay. All right, here's my insight into Room.
Yeah.
It people need to stop calling it The Room.
Agreed.
That is a separate movie.
And not a good one.
Well, that movie's great in its own way, but in a very different way from the way that Room is. So,
right, okay. The Room is a movie that has become a cult classic by virtue of just how spectacularly awful it is.
Yeah, and it's like, if you like those sort of things, the kind of mystery science theater, like,
yeah.
How does it get made? It's so bad.
It's one of the best.
It's enjoyable. You can't get much better than The Room.
No, The Room is, it's hilariously bad yeah. is the only way yeah. to describe it.
Now, what do you like about Room?
Oh, my. So we know, well established, I'm not big on bad time entertainment unless there's something really grabbing about it. And I would not call this bad time entertainment, but it is heavily dramatic and it is difficult in a lot of ways. For those of you who do not know what Room is, I think without spoiling, what I can say is that it is a movie that begins with the premise of a young woman who was kidnapped at age 17, and when you meet her, She is confined to a one-room shack with her now 5-year-old son, who, you know, you can assume where that son came from, and living her life now 7 years captured in this one room. And I don't want to spoil anything, so I won't say much more than that, besides the fact that Brie Larson, who plays the woman, and Jacob Tremblay, who plays the 5-year-old, are unbelievable. I mean, I knew Brie Larson was great. I've loved Brie Larson for a bit now. She was really wonderful. This kid, it's the best under 10 years old acting performance I've ever seen in my life, and I'm not sure it's even close.
Wow.
He was... Because, I mean, he's playing a kid whose whole life has taken place in, like, a 5x15 room. And for a child to be able to understand and convey the emotions and... I mean, I just cannot say, and I'm just looking this up now, he's actually now 9 years old. May have been 8, probably was 8 when they were shooting the movie. For a child like that to be able to understand just the premise and the film at a level to give the performance he gave is earth-shattering in my eyes. Wow. And also just beyond that, I thought it was one of the most affecting, sort of intense... I mean, never mind the fact that I cried at least 5 times, which is only a little less than normal for me in a movie. There were moments where my whole body was, like, trembling with excitement. And it wasn't like a big thriller, exactly. It was just, like, the emotional toll of the situations, and again, I really don't want to spoil anything about it because I went in going knowing probably less than I've already said, but
yep.
I gotta say, from an emotional affecting from how it was affecting emotionally, it was unbelievable, and the acting performances were out of this world.
I think at some point we may have to roll through our list of great child performances. Because now you got me thinking with the potential best ever.
I would have to think, but this was just truly incredible.
I haven't seen it yet. It's on my list. I'm hoping that some of these screeners that are floating around for award season finally make their way to the internet for me. Just kidding. Big Brother in the Sky. But I did have a couple questions. The first of which is, so when you cry in the movies, do you do that thing where you have to kind of like look around to see if anybody's noticing that you're crying?
Nah, man, I don't care.
You know, you just
also
are
I don't.
Are you just full on sobbing?
No, cry is probably the wrong word. I really mean like well up. You know, maybe a tear or two slips down. Like, but that's like, as I get older, I am a more emotional mess.
This thing that is happening to me too, with just mostly with movies, like
yeah.
The right score can get me like all sorts of just like I can be a wreck. It doesn't.
Yeah.
The movie doesn't even have to be good. Like that's the thing that freaks me out is that there are times when I'm watching a stupid movie,
yes.
But it's playing the right notes with the score, and I'm just like, oh god.
Yeah, it's music. It's almost like moments that used to just kind of give me a little goosebumps when I was 25. At 34, I'm like tearing up like I'm going through menopause or something.
And I've read something about this, so I feel at least a little bit better about it, that there's an actual science behind this. But on planes, it's the worst.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
The worst.
Well, I'll tell you, altitude, that's essentially like low-key altitude sickness because when I was 19-ish, my father and I climbed Mount Kilimanjaro. And the last day of that, I literally, there was a point at which, for reasons I could, for like no reason essentially, and I didn't understand it at the time, where like some small thing happened and I just broke down like an infant. And I was like, wait, what is happening here? And you know, came to realize later that day when I was 1,000 feet lower that, like, oh, man, the altitude was really getting to me. It does mess with your brain.
That was a really strong, low-key humble brag about Brown climbing Mount Kilimanjaro.
Thank you. Thank you. I'll show you pictures sometime.
You know, I found when I'm riding the back of a great white shark in the barrier reefs that I tear up sometimes, you know?
It's
really a place for soul searching.
As a child, I was lucky enough to have parents who spent all their money taking us wonderful places. It's good because I will never have the money to do that myself as an adult.
Yeah, so you got it out of the way.
That's right. All right,
so here's my second thing, kind of observation about Room. I haven't seen Room. I want to. I also really like Brie Larson, and I like her in this way, like, you know, now that it's kind of award season, right, and you find her sitting there, and you're, like, rooting for her win.
Oh, totally.
Right?
100%.
And I don't know what it is. Like, if you were like, well, what are the things that you like Brie Larson from? And I'd go, well, United States of Tara, she was, like, the teen daughter, I thought she was really cool, and I...
She was in Trainwreck. She was really good in Trainwreck. You know,
I know that she's done some other things and maybe more important work, and I know that she's very talented.
Yeah.
But I don't know what it is about her that, like, you know, you sort of identify with her as like, yeah, I like her.
Yeah.
I want her to do well. But that's the way I feel.
I recognized
feel like
her
not uncommon.
I recognized her mostly from The Spectacular Now and Community. She just had a few episode arc on Community, I want to say.
Who was she on Community?
Just some chick, you know. She didn't have a big. She also, I'm just seeing this now and I don't remember, but apparently she was in a couple episodes of The League a few years ago as well.
Don't remember that. Seen all the episodes of The League.
Yeah,
she was great in the Jenny Lewis video. Just one of the guys.
Yeah, and she also she was in Scott Pilgrim too.
Yeah,
and a handful of other things. But for me, it was really The Gambler and Trainwreck where I saw her actually play, you know, bigger roles, and really was like, oh yeah, that girl, she's great.
Just one of those people that whenever you see, you enjoy, you know? You're like,
She was also in Don John. I also would say she's one of those people that, like, isn't... I mean, look, she's a movie star. She's very pretty. But she also, I feel like, is someone who is attractive beyond her physical appearance for whatever reason. She has one of those magnetic...
She's an approachable kind of pretty.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Yeah, but in like, a very magnetic way. In my eyes, I'm a big fan.
There you go. All right, so let's move on to Hateful Eight real quick because I did see that, and I know you've seen it as well.
Yes. Should we spoiler alert? Are we going to spoil?
I don't think so.
Okay.
First of all, it's a little bit of a tough movie to spoil because you kind of know.
Yeah, it's Quentin Tarantino, and it hits all the notes.
Right. Do you think, let's start with, do you think, you know, because Tarantino's been pretty vocal about the screenplay. We talked a little bit about this last week about wanting to get screenplay Oscar noms for every movie. This one didn't get one.
Yeah.
Do you feel like it's deserved?
I think that's a twofold question. I feel like it is... probably deserved in terms of what got nominated, but it's not his best writing work.
I think that's the thing about it is it's just, you know, the film will suffer somewhat, I think, from the bar that he's set. It's just low-grade Tarantino, and that's great.
Is it low-grade? I wouldn't call it low-grade. I would say it is... It's hard to describe what it is without using an insulting word, but it is like boilerplate Tarantino, but that's still good.
Right. It's still good.
Yeah.
I mean, it's still Tarantino.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, but here's the thing. Like, I haven't seen Bridge of Spies, but I doubt it has a better screenplay than Hateful Eight. And I loved Straight Outta Compton. But I'm not sure it had a better screenplay than Hateful
Eight.
That's
the Straight Outta Compton screenplay is
fine.
Funky at times.
It's
you know
fine.
What I mean?
Yeah.
We're not going to nominate you for Best Picture, but we want to recognize you in some way sort of nomination.
Well, that's all kinds of offensive.
You know what I mean?
Because it definitely belongs on this Best Picture. It was. I thought it was better than The Martian. We had this last week,
yeah,
didn't we?
Yeah, I did not. I know. We're going to get right back into it. I feel like, you know, when you have a movie like this that essentially the movie's basically a play. In fact, I hear he may want to stage it at some point.
Yeah, because it's one room. It's
one room or a stagecoach,
right.
Pretty much, the whole way. It's people, it's characters talking in a room. You could do it as a play.
Yeah. It would be one bloody play, as you could say about any Tarantino movie.
Yes. And also, like any Tarantino movie, it's clocking in at close to 3 hours. And I think that when you have a movie where the dialogue doesn't have the snap of some of his most electric work, you know, and he's really, to me, coming in on a roll. Like, the last two Tarantino films are incredible.
I love them. I would say snap is probably the right way to put it. It doesn't pop in the same way.
Yeah.
But it is clever and fun and well written.
Yes, there's a lot to love, but I guess my point is that when you don't have quite that same electricity, it does expose, I think, more over a running time that's close to 3 hours, where you start to go, okay, do we really need this chapter of the story? Story's divided up into chapters,
mm-hmm.
And you don't always know what the answer to that is.
I think that's fair.
Yeah,
I think that's fair, and I think the biggest thing in general about this movie that is getting it anything less than pretty glowing reviews is just the standard that's been set.
Yeah,
I mean, I think if this was Tarantino's first movie, I mean, you'd never get this made as a first movie, but if we didn't know as much about Tarantino and we hadn't just seen Django and Inglourious Basterds, I think people would think even better of The Hateful Eight. I really do, because have you seen The Revenant?
I've not seen The Revenant yet, no.
Okay. Well, I guess here's what I'm getting at, is I think if Quentin Tarantino had made The Revenant, there would be significantly less excitement about The Revenant. It's beautiful. And frankly, I thought Hateful Eight was better than The Revenant, but my point is, like, we are taking for granted all of the stuff that we know Tarantino does. It's beautifully, immaculately shot. It is funny, clever dialogue. It's subversive violence, if you're willing to accept that interpretation of Tarantino. All this stuff that has become boilerplate Tarantino is pretty awesome and incredible to get done. But we just know he can do it, so we're less impressed.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's true. I definitely agree that if this was like a first-time filmmaker, we'd be talking about how young and exciting and brash this guy is and the potential. Sometimes – and look, maybe it's a movie that becomes more greatly appreciated. I do find that the lesser celebrated Tarantino work – his Death Proof movie, or Grindhouse movie, which I think was Death Proof, right?
It was Death Proof, yeah.
Yeah. I think holds up well. A really enjoyable movie, kind of underrated.
That's actually, it's the only one I haven't seen.
Same with Jackie Brown.
I think, really underrated. I actually would say it's better than, Jackie Brown has aged as well as about any movie ever. It is awesome to go back and watch, and at the time, nobody really cared.
Yeah, no, I think that's fair.
There's also something, and I do my best to avoid just outright stealing from the Watch podcast, but there's something that they mentioned that I think is relevant here. I think it was them, which is that Tarantino's movies kind of go in three packs, and the third movie is usually sort of a different handling of similar situations to the first two. It was Reservoir Dogs, Pulp Fiction, and then Jackie Brown. And in this case, these revenge movies of Inglourious Basterds, Django, and Hateful Eight. And Hateful Eight, it's harder. Part of the joy of Inglourious Basterds and Django was we all participated in the revenge. And we all perfectly understood who the bad guys were and were excited, probably in fact waiting with bated breath in some cases, for those bad guys to be dealt with in violent fashion. Hateful Eight has more violence that you have to kind of figure out and that you have to kind of reckon with. Is this reasonable? It's not as right in front of you, and I think in some ways that makes it harder for people to process.
Yeah, I suppose. Although I don't know that you can term those movies as a revenge trilogy when revenge is such an overarching theme of his entire career.
Yeah.
I mean, you left out a movie. Right. There was a two-part movie that was literally exclusively about revenge.
Yeah, so, that's true. These are broader revenge, these last three.
Yeah.
These are righting historical wrongs to a degree. Although again, Hateful Eight kind of doesn't do that in a way.
No.
Maybe the trilogy isn't the best example. It's just I do think that Hateful Eight has aspects of Inglourious Basterds and Django, but it's less clear, if that makes sense.
You know, and another thing that we didn't mention about Tarantino's filmmaking that's at work here and in all of his movies is really he's got a great sense of how to play with excellent and in some cases, in fact, many cases, underutilized actors.
Yeah, Kurt Russell.
Kurt Russell was fantastic. Jennifer Jason Leigh deserves all the credit that she's getting.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's really been good about finding some of those talented people who haven't worked in a while and getting great stuff out of them. And he's consistently done that through his career. And there are a lot of other smaller performances in the film that I thought were really good, too.
I completely agree. All right.
Let's move on to TV real quick. I wanted to bring up something that I'm doubting that you noticed over a holiday weekend chalked up with, you know, playoff football and some interesting basketball and all sorts of other stuff. Did you notice that TBS
funny?
Yes, very funny.
Uh-huh.
Had a 25-hour marathon, a binge-a-thon, they called it, of a new show called Angie Tribeca.
I did, only because I'm a big Rashida Jones fan. Aware of this. I could not commit to it on a Sunday that had playoff football, but I intend to get around to Angie Tribeca.
Yeah, it's from Steve Carell and his wife, mm-hmm. Nancy Walls, I believe is her name. And I don't bring it up for the show itself. It's the show's very, you know, it's from the School of Airplane, where we're going to throw
very silly.
1,000 silly jokes at you, and some of them will land and some of them won't. But it's the first entry into what essentially is going to be a reinvention of both TBS and TNT. They want to roll out 12 new shows, and they want those shows over the next year to be more ambitious. And, you know, between, I think, you know, for context, you've got to understand that both TBS and TNT are, you know, they're two of the most successful networks on television.
And they've built that largely on syndication.
Yes.
Yeah.
And syndication, and then the original program has sort of been fluff. You throw USA sort of in that mix as well.
Mm-hmm. Although they have... It's not like they've been putting out a lot of prestige TV, but USA has been taking shots in a way that I think those other ones
have
not.
And that's what I guess is what I'm saying. You know, both, you know, there was a point, you know, if you go back 2-3 years, you'd say all three of those channels were watched, but not respected.
Yeah.
And, you know, USA is now a little further along in the curve, although really they've got one show, Mr. Robot, that's highly buzzed.
Right. Their other shows are not necessarily respected, although they are watched, I think.
They just launched a show called Colony that from Carlton Cuse, I believe, from Lost.
Yes, correct. And it's got Sawyer. What's his face? Sawyer. Yeah, Sawyer from Lost.
Yeah, that's
Josh
another
Holloway?
Bid.
Josh Holloway, is that his name?
I think so. I believe it's Josh Holloway. Yeah. That's another bid for that kind of thing.
Right.
And you, TBS and TNT are doing the same, and I think that you're going to see a lot more of this because channels are starting to look around and think about how they're going to survive in an unbundled world.
Yeah.
And shows that people will talk about and are excited about are now going to be the greatest commodity. And so,
well, that's that in itself is interesting to me because even as that clearly appears to be true, it has not really been explained to me whether that's a functional or profitable model.
Well, we don't know. I think no one knows.
Because a lot of the shows that are, quote, talked about, which are generally, I think, the shows you and I are watching, and the shows that the zeitgeist respects, if you will, my understanding is that traditionally they've not been in front of that many eyes, relatively speaking. You know, far fewer people. We glowed about Fargo on this podcast. You made me watch it, much to your credit and my enjoyment. And yet,
not that many people watched.
Right. As big as the conversation seems to be in the right circles and in the circles that want to have deep discussions about television, many, many, many more people are watching The Big Bang Theory or CSI or probably Criminal Minds. That's what I'm curious about.
Well, I think that there's a couple of things there. One, there's an issue of measurement and, in this era of DVRs and time shifting and streaming and,
yeah.
It can be hard to, notice how things are being watched, hard to understand how things are being watched. There's sort of the famous example of Breaking Bad, which started out as a show, in sort of that Mad Men, Fargo kind of range, Americans kind of range of beloved and critically adored and much discussed, but not watched. And then, as Netflix streaming came along and became a thing, right, people started streaming that show. And by the end of its run, it was one of the most watched shows.
Yeah. Don't you think that show's somewhat unique? And I think it has...
Yeah. I'm not saying that's typical, but what I'm saying is that, there are audiences that, are gained over time on these streaming services, and they kind of happen under our noses.
Well, my point was actually that the unique combination of... I don't really have the right word to describe quality television production, but prestige TV or whatever you want to call it, the unique combination for Breaking Bad of a show that was well written and spectacularly acted, but also incredibly fulfilling on an escapist level.
Yeah.
That's just really hard to do. I think that's why Mad Max is getting so much Oscar buzz, to quickly jump back into movies, is that it's a movie that is basically an escapist action film, but it's so well done that people who like to break things down more than the average action film are also loving it. And I feel like that's the space that Breaking Bad lived in, and it's just really hard to make a show that good that's also that basely entertaining. And those are the audiences, essentially. There's people who want to think deeply and have conversations about television that are watching things like Fargo, and there are people who want to be
kill zombies, woo!
Exactly, who are watching The Walking Dead or, CSI, and those audiences overlap pretty infrequently, I feel like.
Yeah, although I think The Walking Dead is a show that is in the latter category, but has these bones and these sometimes designs to try to reach into the former.
Right.
Which is where it can get in trouble.
Well, but that's why The Walking Dead, while it probably is watched by just as many, if not more people, is definitely not as good of a show as Breaking Bad.
Right?
Well, but I think it's a much more likely show to get to be profitable, at least as I understand profitable TV.
I guess, but, there are a couple things to talk about here. The first is Netflix. I tweeted this out the other day that Netflix is investing like $5 billion in content, in original content for 2016. So they're spending $5 billion on shows. Mm-hmm. So clearly there is some revenue and scale, and you know for them, I think that's a function of their being worldwide and taking that many subscriptions, and understanding that they need this sort of fuel to justify that ongoing.
So their also, model is so different from everybody else's, right?
Their model is, well, it's different from, it's definitely different from ABC or AMC or USA. It's somewhat similar to HBO in that what they need to do are stoke fan passions and conversations and make their channels feel essential. And I guess what I'm saying is all these channels are envisioning a world in which you may need to have the USA app or the or the Turner app to get them, or you know, where they may want to sell them as standalones. And to do that, you have to have a certain kind of commodity. And I think what it's done, to kind of tie it back into what you're saying earlier, is that it's pushed television to go to really try to go for these impossible feats where they make things that are entertaining and escapist while also being of the highest quality. And I feel like it's really pushed that medium, you know, so much further forward than what's happening in music or film right now, where they're sort of out of ideas or really trying to, you know, the economics of film are such that you're trying to make movies that are great for worldwide markets and have really easy to get concepts that anyone in any country would watch, you know? So that's a very different sort of, like, more we want to land smack in the middle kind of idea. And I think, well, you know, it's just been great for TV. You know?
I totally agree with that. The issue for me is that I have no data to support this, but I believe that the economics of the film industry are being bungled. The concept that it's better anytime people start making art, anytime people make artistic decisions based on potential viewership, I think you're walking down a bad and stupid road. And in my eyes, you would have more success making quality films and trying to sell them to overseas audiences than you would trying to make films that sell to overseas audiences. And I don't just mean you'd make better movies, because I think that's obvious. I mean, I think you would make just as much, if not more, money.
Yeah, to I don't
me,
know.
To me, this is very similar to the not wanting to have a playoff in college football. Is everyone's like, but look at all the money we're making. And they refuse to accept the fact that you would all make more money and have a better product if you just did what was right. I think that is the same with movies. And I think that is the, while that's not the thought process, that is the essential result of the TV phenomenon you're talking about with HBO and Netflix, because there's no specific numbers goal. There is only, we have to create something that makes people feel like we are necessary. In other words, we have to create something great. Yes. And so here we have TV studios and channels out there with the goal of making something great. And they're making great things. Who knew? How could you have possibly predicted this? Meanwhile, movies are out there trying to create things that they think fit a certain description of success, and there's a lot of crap. Yeah, and a lot of it is not making any money.
You've got to find the sweet spot where you're trying to make things that some people will love. You know what I mean? Whereas, as opposed to trying to make things that all people will love. You can't make things that only a few people will love. Actually, there's room enough on TV to do that.
There is.
I mean, obviously, there's plenty of shows that are doing that. But there's a real nice sweet spot where you can hit things that a lot of people will love and talk about and people are happy. You've now derailed me to the point where all I can think about is I want to harangue people who are decrying that the playoff has devalued the Bulls.
Ugh.
As if that's a thing that we need to protect.
Ugh. And now there's the same idiots who didn't want to have a college football playoff in the first place are now saying, well, we can't possibly have more than four teams in it. And it's like, just stop it, and we can all get to the 8 or 12 team playoff we want, and everything will be better. Stop it. But they won't stop it.
Yeah. But then the Bulls won't. No, yes, they won't. The Bulls are exhibition games.
Yep. They always were.
Yes. I'm just going to jump off of that tangent.
Sorry.
I'm going to move us because we got to get to. We've been talking about it for weeks.
Yeah.
Our all-time trash talk team.
This was harder than I thought for me. I don't know about you.
Yeah, it was difficult. It was difficult to kind of – now, tell me what you used for parameters, because I decided a couple of things that
okay.
I wanted to stay in team sports. Like,
yeah, I stepped outside briefly, but go on.
You know, it's tough to talk about all-time trash talkers without thinking about, like, Muhammad Ali.
That's exactly the one.
But I feel like the trash talking is just so part – it's, like, kind of just the nature of that sport, and you're talking about something – when you're talking about something that's one guy versus another guy,
but
know,
doesn't that make
fighting things like,
doesn't that make Ali all the more impressive? This is the – and, yes, he was the best ever. And I guess we'll get to that when we get to basketball as well. But in a sport where trash talking is a legitimate part of the experience, he was so much better than anyone ever. He was clever. He was smart. He was funny. He took jabs at guys you never would have expected. He hit all the trash talk notes. Muhammad Ali is probably the greatest trash talker of all time.
All right, so I doubt that you've thought about this, but I'm just curious, like, who's your greatest pro wrestling trash talker of all time?
Never been a pro wrestling guy.
Never?
No, I just don't have the knowledge for that.
Even like, as a kid?
No. I mean, I saw some. I vaguely remember the Hart brothers and the Undertaker and
yeah.
You know, I could throw some names at you and remember a couple of things about some of those wrestlers, but I was never, like... Yeah. In on the soap opera.
Because that's one of those things where the trash talking there is like literally part of the art. And
yes,
are,
but they
are
don't.
Many people who have been successful wrestlers mainly because they're good at trash talking.
Well, that's
you know
the job.
I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. That's the difference with boxing is that's not the job. It's just part of the experience.
It's part of the experience. I agree. I was just throwing it out there as a side note.
Yeah.
All right. Best trash talkers of our current era. Let's start there.
Current era.
Yeah.
Wow, do I have written down nobody from the current era.
Nobody from the current era. Not.
There's one, actually. There's one. He's not from the current era, but he is still playing.
Okay. I had a whole category of active guys.
Okay.
And I think you gotta start with Draymond.
Yes, no doubt. Draymond's on that list.
Draymond, what I like about Draymond is that, you know, a lot of guys who are trash talkers, you know they're trash talkers because... You hear about a story,
right.
Or this thing happened, and this, you know, it gets out. Draymond is a guy who's talking trash on the court, who's
yep.
talking trash in the media.
He never stops.
Yeah, and I just think I love it. I love it. The 100% honesty.
He's
got
the best.
To...
He's absolutely he, and I don't mean that. I mean that qualitatively. He is the best. Period. Full stop. He's such a good player. He's such a great teammate. He does whatever you need from him on the court. He never stops talking. He always has something to say and is usually funny or relevant or clever or smart. I can't say enough good things about Draymond Green as a whole. And the fact that in his rookie year, he gets put on LeBron James and immediately starts talking trash and then hits a game-winning layup against the Heat. Like, that, to me, defines Draymond Green.
Yeah, and here's the thing. To me, like, the guys that I mostly want to celebrate, I definitely gravitate towards fun trash talkers.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Sure.
Like, I want guys that make me laugh and guys that are having a good time. You know, there is a certain category of guy, as you and I have talked about, I am not a Kevin Garnett fan.
He's on my list.
Anathema to say here in Minnesota.
I
don't like
him.
Yeah,
how do you live there?
He's a dirty player.
He's not a dirty player.
I think he's the kind of guy who trash talks to rip out your soul.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I just enjoy that less.
Fine. But it counts.
Than a guy like Draymond who's like fun.
I get that, and I probably agree with you, but I love KG, as you know. I don't think he's a dirty player. I think that's just something that you say because it's like identifiable and it's a way to denigrate someone that you don't like.
No. That guy's got a litany of cheap shots in his history, not to mention fights. All right.
What fights? He's in the NBA. regardless of all of that, there's no question he's on the trash talk list, and he is actually the only active athlete that I have. He's vicious. You said it. He trash talks to tear your soul out, and it's beautiful. I love it.
You got to also mention Paul Pierce, his longtime teammate,
He's low key, but he's in there too.
Sometimes, yeah, shooting that 3-pointer in the playoffs against the Hawks last year, where incorrectly went series. You know what I mean? It's like, to me, sort of classic Paul Pierce.
Yeah. But
and Scalabrine, who played with both, said Pierce is the greatest trash talker you'd ever seen.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
So,
I'm a big Scalabrine fan as well, and I'm a fan of his doppelganger Michael Rapaport.
You got to mention Richard Sherman.
Yeah.
In active players.
Sure.
And Richard Sherman's a guy I like because, he can be a little bit more in that latter one of, like, I think we're about your soul category.
He's definitely in that one.
But he often picks great targets. I mean, anyone who goes after Skip Bayless on First Take.
Good for him.
You've earned an all-time trash talk slot.
Agreed. And
just right then and there.
And he is really smart. Like you said, he knows which targets to pick. It seems like all of the talking he does, even when it fails, is to a point. He's definitely on the current list.
Yeah. And then I think I have to mention the guy that essentially started this conversation.
Right.
I guess he did cross the line now, I guess, from active to retired. But that's Steve Smith.
Yeah.
Who started this by trash talking a guy on Twitter.
Are you sure?
I think he retired, right?
Gosh, I hope not.
Yeah, I think he did. I could be wrong.
He got hurt and lost his season.
I thought he had said before the year that this one was going to be his last.
Hmm.
But Steve Smith's the greatest.
He's the best.
A lot of these wide receiver guys are big physical specimens. Your Julio Joneses and Calvin Johnsons and Randy Mosses. And here's Steve Smith at like 5'9".
5'9".
Yeah. And just coming in the league, a tougher mofo than anybody else. And you want to talk about a vengeance guy. Like the teams that made Steve Smith angry, forget it. What a player.
Things he said, talked about, he told that guy to ice up. He talked about breaking people's sporks. I mean, he has some of the best lines of all time. He did say before 2015 that it would be his last season, but he said after the injury that he would come back.
Oh, great. Great. All right.
So hopefully he will be back. He did. I think he tore an Achilles. So, at 36, God knows. But also, Smith gets extra credit in my book as a trash talker because it sort of feels like being a crazy trash talker is part of what allowed him to have the longevity and success he did. Like that he basically put together a Hall of Fame career on pure force of will and trash talk.
Yeah. I would agree. And always a guy that you were terrified of. This little 5'9 guy. And it seemed like all the guys on the field were terrified
Completely
of him.
Completely terrified.
Which is
big,
just
scary
awesome.
Men terrified of a 5'9 guy. Absolutely. Yeah.
All right. So give me some of your all time guys.
All right. See, now, first of all, I got stuck in basketball. What I did was I kind of put together a starting five that doesn't totally – I mean, I guess I could throw Shaq in there and bring Reggie off the bench to make it a six-man team
An
and have a real center.
Five. Yeah, okay.
But to me – and so let's do that. Let's put Shaq at center because it was fun-loving and sometimes it was more just talk than trash talk. But Shaq had a lot of fun, man.
Shaq had a lot of fun, and tell me how my ass tastes.
That's pretty incredible.
That's an all-timer.
It is. All right, so if we put Shaq at center, my power forward is KG, who we already mentioned, and it's vicious, but he's out there making people – I mean, do you remember when he made the joke about Charlie Villanueva not having any hair, and it's like literally a medical condition? Like, it's vicious and mean and over the top, and I can't get
it
out.
Yeah, see, I just, for me, it's like, your wife tastes like Honey Nut Cheerios.
Oh, God, it's come on.
I don't find that funny. I just find that like, eh.
It's not, I don't think Carmelo should find it funny, but to a degree, it's funny to me just that anyone cares that much about anything to say that to someone just to try to get a mental edge.
It's hilarious that someone might care that much about their wife.
No. I mean that Kevin Garnett cares enough about winning that game to try to get in Carmelo's head by saying such foul things. That's what I mean.
Right. I'm just saying, if I want to power forward on my all-time trash talk team, give me Rasheed Wallace.
Yeah. The problem with Rasheed is, like, it far too often crossed over into now you're just screaming and getting thrown out of the basketball game.
Well, you know,
I love Rasheed. He's one of my top five favorite players of all time. But I'll take KG for trash talk because I'm not worried that KG is going to get so hyped by his own trash talk that he loses control.
Yeah, but like Sheen would trash talk the media.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. Like,
both teams played hard.
Go with anybody.
Both teams played hard, my man.
Yeah. All right.
All right, so I'll go KG, but Rasheed's a good mention. Obviously,
by the way, the possibility that either KG or Rasheed could be coaches in the league someday.
Oh my god, amazing! Rasheed's gonna
phenomenal.
Be a coach.
Yeah, I agree. No, I think Rasheed's happening.
It's amazing. It's so amazing. Ball don't lie.
That's another one. I mean, ball don't lie.
That's not trash talk though. That's said on every playground in America.
But that's what I mean. Is it is now?
No,
you know what I mean.
I said that before Rasheed. Before I ever heard it from Rasheed Wallace, we said that.
All right, I'll defer to your streets of Chicago.
I mean, I wasn't exactly in the mean streets, but I played a lot of pickup basketball, and you would say that because didn't you ever have like you'd have a dispute and you'd have to shoot for it?
Oh sure, like I understand where it comes from, but I feel like Rasheed Wallace popularized it. And
yeah,
I don't
no,
think
he
I
popularized
said
it for sure, for sure,
saying it,
for sure.
I mean?
Yeah, no, that's true. That's true. And I can still hear him say it in my head.
Exactly. Like, that's the way you say it, right? You're like, ball don't lie.
Yeah.
That comes from Sheed.
Yep, that's true. That's true.
All right.
All right, so here's my backcourt. Obviously, I got Jordan.
Right.
People, I don't think, realize he was on the KG tip, by the way, of Vicious. But he never shut up.
Yeah. And I mean, you have to shout out for a guy that used his Hall of Fame induction speech to talk trash.
Like, still angry.
Yeah.
Still talking trash to people who are so far below him. Like, you know how you don't beef down? Well, all Jordan does is beef down.
Yeah.
But he's just such a crazy competitor. I don't think he can help himself.
Do you think it's sort of amazing, though, that, like, there's going to be a generation of kids coming up that knows Michael Jordan essentially
I don't want to talk about it.
The guy with the shoes and the guy crying on the internet.
I don't want to talk about it. So Jordan's my shooting guard. My point guard, I'm thinking you might be able to guess, is the glove, Gary Payton.
Yeah, no doubt.
Absolutely awesome and a little more colorful and fun than I think Jordan or KG. And then here's my – as I mentioned, Reggie Miller would be my sixth man because obviously Jordan's starting, but Reggie was fun. And with the choking thing for Spike Lee, just the stuff he would say off the court, Reggie is funny and entertaining. And I didn't love him as a player, but I do enjoy his personality.
Do you love him as an announcer?
He's fine. I actually like Chris Webber as an announcer if we want to talk about people.
Miller's
I like.
Just there to me a
yeah.
lot of times.
I agree. He's fine. He's funny. He's an entertaining personality. He's not a great basketball analyst. My three, though, is Larry Bird. Larry Bird, I think, is one of the great low-key trash talkers of all time. And
that's
probably,
I was like, you better say Bird, man. You better say Bird.
Yeah. I mean, probably more in the vicious category, but also clever. And also, there's something about a guy who looks like that talking trash.
Yep. I agree, 100%. And plus, just, you know, Wavo's like onions kind of trash. Like, when he, you know, the fame story about when he walked into the locker room before the first three-point contest and was like, all right, which one of you motherfuckers is finishing second?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, that kind of stuff. It's great. Yeah. It's great. And it sort of adds to Larry Legend. That's another guy that I am worried that as time moves – you know, that there's going to be generations of people who just don't understand the treasure that is Larry Bird.
Well, let me tell you about what kind of creepy nerd I am, is literally within the last week, I spent about 35 minutes watching Bird highlights on YouTube. And if people want to see how incredible Larry Bird is, a good place to start is Googling Larry Bird's best passes. Because there are no less than 4 or 5 15-minute compilation videos of just passes. And not even, like, long shots. I mean, a 7 or 8 minute video is going to have, like, 50 passes in it. And they're incredible. He's passing. It's, like, literally the least impressive thing he did. And it's mind-blowing. The guy was a basketball natural in a way that few others have been.
Yeah, I sports hated that guy so much as a kid.
Sure.
You know, I loved Magic, so you know, you're anti-Bird.
Yeah.
But to do that, right, you do that only because someone is good and because they're terrifying and because they just, you know.
As the great Reggie Jackson said, they don't boo nobodies.
Right, exactly. And he was that guy. Like, you just, he was unkillable. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
It, you know, it's interesting to me, and this is a tangent off of this real quick. I feel like the current NBA, that you know, setup reminds me so much of that 80s setup where you had three teams. You knew in the 80s, right, it was going to be the Lakers, and they were going to play either the Sixers or the Celtics. And then
the Pistons come along.
Right, and the Pistons came along. But it was, you know, it was like kind of that, and that's what the NBA sort of looks like now. And I'm finding that I'm highly enjoying it, even though it renders the regular season largely moot.
Somewhat,
you know?
Yeah.
But it's not like there weren't other good teams in the 80s, and it's not like there aren't other good teams now.
Right.
But when
and,
it gets
and
down
more,
to it.
More
know.
So now, I would say, a lot of other great players to watch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there were good guys. You know, you had your Dominiques and your
of course.
Bernard Kings and your Isaiahs, and there were lots of fun people to watch back then. But, you know, the league was about three guys, and that was a credit, I think, to, you know, the guys leading those teams.
Yeah, totally agree.
All right, I want to throw out a couple guys in some other sports.
Yes, I have. I have one baseball name written down.
Me too. Who is your baseball name?
Nolan Ryan.
Oh, good one.
Yeah, that was was a red-assed old man by the time he was finishing up, and he would still put it on anybody, as he showed Robin Ventura very publicly.
I had a guy best known for playing for your Chicago White Sox.
Hmm.
AJ Pierzynski.
Oh, AJ, of course.
Yeah.
I can't believe I forgot AJ.
Yeah. Now,
oh, he's my guy.
Like, entire leagues hated him.
AJ, I apologize. He's a beautiful
strangely,
man.
By the way, he's, you know, he's an Atlanta Brave now.
Yep.
And beloved in that clubhouse. And
he's like, beloved. The only clubhouse he was ever in where he wasn't beloved is the Giants. And I don't know exactly what happened.
No, also the Red Sox.
Yeah, he was there for like 6 weeks, though.
A little Wasn't longer it? Than that, but yeah, no, they were like, we're getting rid of this dude.
Yeah, so. Well, frankly, far be it from me to speak ill of the team that I cover and definitely need to curry the favor of, but to me, that's a problem with the Red Sox and the Giants, because if you don't want that guy in your clubhouse and you can't figure out how to enjoy and get along with that guy, I don't know what you're doing.
All right. Well, it was definitely a surprise to me, because I didn't want him in my locker room.
He rides for his guys. That's what he does. And so I don't know why anyone who was his teammate would have had a problem with him, but that's just me.
All right, so here's some other guys that I want to throw out from other sports.
All right.
Shannon Sharpe.
Yeah, it's a good one.
An all-time great trash talker. Just, you know, and you know, the famous one where he's on the sidelines where he's like, call the Army, call the Navy, because we are killing the Patriots. Just phenomenal. Phenomenal in the annals of fun.
Yeah.
Terrell Owens.
Sure.
Get your popcorn.
Get your popcorn ready.
Some tremendous touchdown celebrations.
Yeah, so I put a couple of touchdown celebrators down.
So many memorable lines.
Yes.
Over the years. You got to mention Primetime.
Yep, he's one of my guys.
Yeah,
I have
he's
Deion
a guy who
down.
Destroy people.
Absolutely, and the whole aura of Deion, the whole thing that he did was unique and original and pretty cool.
Yeah, so those are some of my favorites.
Here's the other two touchdown celebrators that I wanted to respect. Ocho Cinco, I'm a huge fan.
Yeah,
a huge fan, and I still love his antics on Twitter, and they are antics. Low key. But maybe my favorite celebration of all time, Joe Horn.
So the cell phone?
The cell phone. So much forethought, such a clever idea. I got to give respect to Joe Horn for the cell phone.
Why do you think the NFL is so against celebrations and props?
Man,
props are phenomenal.
Why do you think they can't figure out what a damn catch is? If I could tell you what's wrong with the NFL and how to fix it, I would be a billionaire. I don't know. I don't know what they're doing. There's literally what could be less harmful than Chad Johnson pretending to putt the football with a pylon.
Yeah,
like,
agree.
What could damage your game less than that? Nothing. It's the most harmless, entertaining, hilarious thing. Why would you outlaw that? Who cares?
I want more things that will make Joe Buck and Troy Aikman mad. That's all I want in life.
Yeah.
Can we have that?
Yeah, Randy Moss fake mooning someone. God forbid. Oh, my God. Oh, children will never think about pulling their pants down the same way again. How dare he? Give me a break.
The best part of that was like, I am completely disgusted by this act. Tonight on Fox, it's Marry a Midget. Join us at 8.
To Joe Buck's credit, I think he would tell you that was misplaced.
No, he defends that to this day.
Really?
Yeah, because he still gets asked about it.
I thought I had heard him back off of that.
Yeah, that was the moment where it was like there was a palpable moment where Joe Buck lost me, and that was it.
Huh.
And here we are 15 years later or whatever, and I'm still stuck with him.
Yeah, I kind of like Joe Buck.
Man, now what are you going
to
do?
That's probably a good note to end on, since we're also way
right,
over time
week,
and I'm going to be late
the
to
NFL.
Work.
Just kidding. Join us next week. Join us next week. We'll have a lot more on a whole bunch of things. This was fun, man.
I think we did well.
All right, we'll talk to you then.
Bye.
This game's in the Admiral refrigerator. The door is closed. The light's out. Butter's getting hard. The eggs are cooling. And the Jell-O is jiggling.
So long, everybody.
And do me a favor. Have yourself a tremendous evening.